Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Joining the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Jeff Frederick, are colleagues from around the university. With him are Amelia Bach, Judy Curtis, and George Harrison from the Department of Mass Communication, and Justin Smith from the Chancellor's Office. Their topic is 21st century media. Now get ready for 30 Brave Minutes.
A quick glance at the FCC database indicates that some 33,000 radio and television stations exist in the United States today as part of an industry that generates in excess of $1 trillion each year and climbing. In a country of 320 million plus, 118 million households are considered television households. The average American spends 32 hours per week watching TV, or approximately 19% of their week. An additional 13 hours per week are spent listening to radio, and another 20 hours per week online, including work use of internet. A full 65 hours, then, are spent consuming or creating digital content in one form or another. The days of Walter Cronkite ruling the nightly news with his crew cut and father figure disposition are long gone, and they aren't returning anytime soon. And to top that off, let's offer a quote from that sage philosopher of all things American culture, Bruce Springsteen. I bought a bourgeois house in the Hollywood Hills with a truckload of $100,000 bills. Man came by to hook up my cable TV. We settled in for the night, my baby and me. We switched round and round till half past dawn. There were 57 channels and nothing on. We're hooked. A typical cell phone user touches their phone an average of 2,600 times per day. 21st century media has changed the way we do almost everything in our lives. This is far beyond the realization that most Americans no longer walk out to their driveway before breakfast to get the morning edition of their local paper in order to start their day. Instead, while we're still in our pajamas, we fire up our laptops, iPads, tablets, and phones to check out our Twitter feeds, to look at new posts on Instagram or Snapchat, to sort through Facebook, to pull up our favorite blog or website, to pick up the latest curated block of news, sports, and pop culture stories heavily tailored to fit our previous reading and viewing habits. While this is an American development whose effects are visible every day, it's more accurately a global development. 974 million Twitter accounts have been created, though to be fair, one study indicated that only 44% of them have actually ever issued a tweet. Famously, some among us, including certain residents of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, do tweet relentlessly, so I do guess it all balances out. Facebook has over 2 billion accounts and climbing. These pages can be used to do everything from post pictures of your lunch, champion your favorite conspiracy theory, sell a product or service your company makes, or reconnect with that lab partner from 10th grade biology. Media in all its forms clearly appears to be more influential, and postmodern conceptualizations suggest that developments in digital technology and applications now make style so much more important than substance, impact more critical than objectivity, or perhaps even news value. And reality television, a wholly unrealistic and contrived platform of shaped outcomes, has become more essential than reality. Our topic for today, 21st century media, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Joining us today are Amelia Bach, Judy Curtis, George Harrison, and Justin Smith. Marshall McLuhan, back in 1958 and later in print, noted famously that the medium is the message, because the medium that shapes and controls the scale and form of human association and action. Amelia, what did he mean? Was he right? And is it still true today in 2018?
Well, I'll kind of start with your last question, that I definitely am a fan of Marshall McLuhan and this idea that the medium is the message. And I think when we talk about media, we tend to privilege talking about content. You know, what are the messages that are being said? What do they mean? What are their effects? We always get really caught up in looking at that. And he was trying to point out that we also need to look at the mediums themselves. The kind of famous example is before the television went into American homes, your living room was organized for conversation. So you had couches and chairs that were organized so that you would face each other and have conversation in the evening. Then we get television and we're very concerned with what is it saying? What are the effects on kids? Look at the effect on how it structures our lives. Now your living room is probably organized around your, you know, digital television. And I think this theoretical concept is very important for us now with, you know, digital technology and portable technology. I mean, look, on campus, students walk around now all the time with their phones out and looking down at their phones. And so it's just not important that we look at content, but we look at the mediums themselves.
I think it's really interesting. How many of us have walked into our house, seeing that the power is off, and yet we still subconsciously reach for the remote to get our time at home started, even though we know it's not going to work. What about the rest of y'all? Is the medium the message?
Well, Marshall McLuhan was during the television era. He was when television was coming in, and of course now we have the internet has replaced television. And so he is a postmodernist, definitely. And the idea that technology, in the words of one researcher, can stretch the ways we know and experience the world is true. But I still think the core of mass communication research still goes back to the ability to look at many different facets of mass communication. So we can look at what Laswell said, who says what, to whom, and what channel with what effect. And so we can concentrate on any of those things, the who as the professional communicator, and in today's world, anyone can be a content creator, as you pointed out. Says what is the content, of course, to whom is the audience, in what channel is definitely the medium used, and then with what effect. So I think McLuhan is still sort of an alternate paradigm in the big history of research in mass communication. And one other thing that he mentioned was the idea of the global village. And so people are thinking, well, he really predicted the internet. But an alternative view to that is the idea that, yes, we're connected now like a global village. But one researcher says we don't really talk with people in other countries. We're more sightseers than engaged. So maybe instead of one global village connected, we're actually small villages that are connected now, but we only visit them occasionally.
Mm. George?
Yeah, I would add to this discussion by saying, to me, it is true that the medium that you use to convey a message absolutely matters in the message acceptance and the way it's accepted by the audience. As an example, we have what we call rich media and lean media. The complexity of the message determines, or should determine theoretically, what medium you use. So you've got a complex message that is fraught with emotion, or has the potential to be fraught with emotion, and has the potential to be misunderstood or misconstrued in some way. Do you tweet that? We see evidences, I think, as you might have pointed out, that we have a famous tweeter who is pretty good at tweeting complex messages, and that has caused problems. So if the message is complex and has the potential to be divisive or emotional among your audiences, then generally speaking, you want to make that a face-to-face communication. The medium would be face-to-face. It would not be necessarily digitized. We see in emails, you know, emails are great if the message is simple. The meeting's going to start tomorrow at 2 a.m. in room 205.
At 2 a.m., none of us will be there.
Or did I say 2 a.m.?
Bad message.
How about 2 p.m. then? Right. But again, yeah, I think you get the point.
Sure. Absolutely.
It's
very
complexity.
Specific, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Justin, what do you think?
So I worked in local TV news up until about 2 years ago in Wilmington and had the opportunity to be there as the station and corporate-wide, the company, was really emphasizing the importance of telling stories across platforms. And so it was really interesting because you would pitch a story in the morning assignment meeting, and you would have to talk about how you would tackle that on air, but also maybe additional details and context that you could provide in your web version of the story that would be available online. And then you get into different flavors of web stories because there's the version that someone might pull up on a desktop computer, and then there's the version that someone may pull up on their mobile phone. You can put primary documents on the web story. You know, you can provide a link to a PDF of that town budget on the web story, but nobody's going to go through that on their phone. Now, that same TV station, they're also doing what we're experiencing right now. They're in the podcasting business, and they're also creating content, over-the-top content for your Roku and that sort of thing. So it's really interesting to see, even at the local level, media organizations embracing the different platforms and figuring out really how they can leverage that.
So there's so much going on in the 21st century, and the developments and the changes are coming so rapidly. Portability, everyone's a content creator, social media. You know, there's just dozens of developments. Which do you think, without a value judgment of good or bad, we might get to that later, which have been most influential?
I think for me, I would definitely have to say portability because, you know, I think the instinct is to say social media. It's changed all of our jobs. It's changed how we get news, how we interact with each other. But really, social media doesn't kind of like blow up and get as popular and impactful until we get the iPhone. So Facebook comes out in 2004. And, you know, I was in college when it came out, and we had to check it on our desktop, our laptop computer. And so it was like checking your email. You went and you read it and you engaged with it, but it didn't really, social media, you know, didn't gain the traction that it has until you could take it with you. Some of the most popular platforms like Instagram and Snapchat, I mean, they rely on portability to be relevant at all.
I think I would say the instant access to content. Now that Google has become a verb, I think everyone Googles, and we can Google anything we want to know and get instant instructions or instant response. So I think the instantaneous access to content is really what's changed our world.
I think it's also, in some sense, allowed us to be collectors of information because it used to be if you had to go to the library and sit in the stacks and, you know, read through all of these things, the process of acquiring the information took forever. Mm-hmm. And then as you're acquiring it, the analysis is forming in your head. Now we collect information so quickly. I wonder if there's another development that's coming to help us make some sense of the information that we require. I wonder if it's somehow lost its value because it's so easy to get now. Influential changes. What would y'all say? Justin, George?
I tend to agree with my colleagues here in saying that the access to content is very impactful. I would think that what may be impactful for one person or group in society may not be the same thing that is impactful to another person or group in society. And I think that's what we in mass media have to wrestle with is that notion. You know, what may be impacting a elderly person and the forms of media that may be impacting and the access, the ways that an elderly person may access content is oftentimes, I would think, very different than the way a young millennial will access content. And so, you know, we have to we have to take that into consideration as well.
If something breaks, an electronic device in your life breaks, the best way to fix it is to find an 8-year-old kid because they just sort of intuitively understand how it works.
Yeah.
Justin, influence?
I agree that it's portability, but I think that George raises an interesting point about how that's going to differ, maybe depending on where you are in your life. I mean, for me, it's portability, no doubt. And I will admit, with the father of a 2-year-old daughter, we pull out the phone at restaurants and we find Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood on YouTube or on the PBS Kids app, and she watches it oftentimes while we eat. And so for us, portability has been a tremendous blessing.
We'll return to our panel in 30 brave minutes in just a moment. UNCP and the College of Arts and Sciences are changing lives through education. To learn more about the college's 16 departments, college highlights, and news, as well as to find past episodes of 30 Brave Minutes and our digital journal Bravery, explore our website. You can also support our academic programs by clicking on the donate button. Additional news and events may be found by following us on Facebook at UNCP College of Arts and Sciences. Remember, wherever you go and whatever you plan to do, you can get there from here.
Well, let's change the topic just for a minute. One of the things that's been in the news an awful lot in the last couple of years is knowledge of sexual assault and discrimination in all quarters of American life, but particularly and perhaps most noteworthy in media life. Discuss conditions today for women in the mass media business. Is it still an old boys' club? Does the fact that we're more hearing about these things give us reason to be encouraged?
I guess they're going to let the women weigh in first.
Yes.
You know, I think that this year and this past year with movements like the Me Too movement really showed, you know, unfortunately in the media industry, as in, you know, many industries, that it's still, you know, a man's world. But I do think with gains that women have made that that is changing. And now women are at a place because of some economic gains that they've made, some gains that they've made, you know, in social life. They're able and willing to speak up about things like sexual harassment in the workplace and sexual assault and stuff like that. I do have to say, as a woman, though, you know, seeing the Me Too movement unfold, that for me it wasn't surprising, even though I was born into, you know, a generation where, you know, I could go to college and I could vote and I could be anything that I wanted to be. I still have lived a very gendered experience in terms of, you know, having dealt with things like sexual harassment in my life. So I still think that we have a long way to go. And you see it really in media content, too. You know, on the one hand, yeah, we have women's sports and women's heroes and we have Wonder Woman, but we still have women being objectified in content all the time. So we still have a ways to go.
You asked, is it still pervasive? My response would be it very much is, as recent cases have pointed out. Interestingly, NPR last week discussed this very question, and they were in the interview, they were mentioning that a couple of years ago, a male columnist from The Atlantic decided to assess what percentage of his sources for his articles were female and what percentage were male. 25% of his sources were women. This information alarmed him and made him realize that this statistic meant something's wrong. So he made a conscious effort to correct that statistic. He has succeeded. He purposefully now ensures that approximately 50% of his sources are women, are female. Now, it's kind of interesting the way he does this. The way he does it is that he changed his opening pitch to females. He used to say something like, "Hi, Jane, can I come and talk to you about a story I'm writing about XYZ?" And the response many times would be, "Well, I think," from Jane, would be, "Well, I think you ought to go talk to John, who's the expert in that subject." So he changed his pitch, just the mere words in which he approached, excuse me, women. He said, now he says, "Hey, Jane, can I come talk to you for your expertise in XYZ?" And just that little nuance of the pitch story has allowed him to get about 50% of his women now becoming his sources. It was interesting because NPR did their own assessment just recently about how many of their sources are female, about 25%. Mm. So the point is, yes, it is still an old boys' club.
There's a lot of process questions to be changed in order to make more than a little bit of headway.
Yeah.
Old boys' club, you still see it?
So obviously there are issues around gender that need to be addressed in media. But one thing that's concerning to me in addition to that, when we look at the type of people who are going into media, and especially from my perspective with, again, local journalism, I'm concerned that maybe we don't have a broad socioeconomic representation. And I wonder how much of that we can attribute to the generally abysmal salaries that many young journalists are receiving, or not young, but early career. You just sort of trace that out, and if someone comes from a low-income family, even a middle-income family, that can't support them much through college. They're leaving college often with thousands of dollars in student loan debt, and then going and working as a reporter somewhere for not much more than minimum wage probably is not very appealing to them, or isn't an option altogether. So I think that we need to look at the wage issue as well and see how that affects women, but also people of color and other folks who are unrepresented or underrepresented.
Well, and most of the world's poor are women. So I think that by looking at that issue, you can also help have more women's voices as well.
Mm. Judy, does it seem different in the newspaper business than in, say, TV?
Well, the newspaper business is less well paid than the TV business. And public relations is even better paid than that. But I wanted to bring some support to the idea of the pay inequality. I think that's across all industries, including higher education, if I may say that. And also, I think as far as the sexual harassment goes, I think it's good that the new generation coming up is not willing to accept what the older generations put up with. I mean, we put up with it and we didn't like it, but as Amelia said, we've all experienced it, where the newer generation of women coming up is saying, no, I'm not going to just accept that that's the way it's going to be. So I think that's positive. As far as opportunities, I would point out that the anchors on NBC, CBS, and ABC Nightly News are still men. We have some advancement there with Lester Holt in a minority situation, but it's still a man's world.
Mm-hmm. Well, we see people making content individually constantly, right? Occasionally walking into a tree by looking mm-hmm. at their phone and taking a picture and posting it somewhere. But let's think a little bit more broadly about an institutional approach. How are institutions, corporations, government entities, universities for that matter, using media in a more savvy way in the 21st century to create influence and impact?
I guess I could start the discussion with a thought. Some government voices are clearly demonizing mainstream media. Perhaps Fox News isn't being demonized as much as some others. And they're demonizing it, these voices in government are demonizing it by calling their news, the mainstream media news, fake news. There's a book out recently called How Democracies Die. It's a new book out. I want to read that book, and I think we probably all should be reading that book. One, and the author points out, to be honest, I can't remember the author's name right now, but he points out that this is one way democracies die, and that we have been in the throes of this for some time now. Certainly an attack on the Fourth Estate, the freedom of the press, and that sort of thing is a critical issue for all of us, I think.
Is it an attack, though? Let me just throw out a different perspective. If my preference is to get the news from one particular point of view, Is it as an attack on the other point of view as much as it is a specific endorsement that the market has created an ability for me to consume the product I want to consume, and I've identified what that product is? Maybe is there an argument that it's less an attack on something else and more an endorsement of the market has created this option and I prefer to buy this product?
But it's not really an equal option if you say the other product is false. So we don't allow for deceptive advertising and false claims. And so rather than saying, well, this is our point of view and that's that point of view and you make up your own mind what you want, if you say my point of view is the only true point of view and everything else is false, then I don't think it's really giving you equal choice.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay to say we like to, we want to hear, or we hear what we want to hear, and that's part of being human, I think, in some ways. We tend to cognitive dissonance, that notion of saying, you know, we hear what we want to hear, but as Judy just pointed out, that's different than calling educated professional journalists fake.
20th century editors and producers made those decisions for most of the content consuming people. Now people are making some of those decisions for themselves. Is that a positive development? You've mentioned the negative side effects on working journalists who are attempting to shoot down the middle and to call it as they see it. Are there other negative developments associated with 21st century media changes?
Well, the speed is a negative if you don't take care to make sure that it's accurate. Accuracy and unintentional errors are different, I think, from what George was discussing in the label of fake news implies intentional deception, and I don't think we have intentional deception in the media, but the desire, even more than in the past, there always was a desire to be first with the news, but the idea that it has to get up on the web the instant it happens before you even verify the sources or verify that it actually did happen, I think is a negative of today's media world.
I'd say another negative, which can also be a positive, but is barrier to entry or lack thereof, because there was something to be said for the big institutions, whether they be newspapers or TV stations or radio stations. Back in the day, there was the barrier to entry, but there was also the profit margin for them to be able to fund quality journalism, and especially concerned at the local level. What happens when that newspaper is no longer there? Who's going to cover the county commissioner's meeting? Who's going to cover the school board? And to George's point, is that when democracy dies? I hope not.
Yeah, and because those topics aren't necessarily the things that, you know, citizen journalists want to cover all the time. I think with every new technology, we get pros and cons. You know, stuff is going to change, and it's going to bring things that are good for society, and it's going to bring things that we have to work through. You know, some of the other, you know, cons, I guess, of the 21st century, you know, media era, I would say are things that we've seen, like cyberbullying, you know, the ability to, like, jump on the bandwagon digitally and, you know, bully people. We see that a lot with middle schools and high schools. And then a little bit lighter, but can be, you know, more serious, is catfishing. Do we all know what catfishing is? Yeah. You know, so the idea of making a fake profile and trying to get money out of people. So the ability to, you know, have the mob mentality on the web or to trick people and get money out of them. You know, I guess that's a con.
We have a very savvy audience here at 30 Brave Minutes, so they're anti-catfishing all the way.
So they've been catfished, and now they know better.
Let's turn the glass of water half empty. You know, make the case that this is the most alive, best time to be a journalist in recent history because of all the tools, because of all the opportunity, because some of the crusty old saws of the industry have given way to more enlightened feeling. Help, help make the case that this is a really exciting time?
Well, there's always going to be a need for information. And I think because there's so many ways to access information now, there's a need for even more people who are able to gather news and package it and deliver it. So I do think it's a wonderful opportunity for people coming into the news business, that it's a growing business. It's changing. I like to say to my students that they're living through the revolution, that the internet is changing everything, and they're still in on the ground floor.
I think there's a tremendous opportunity, an exciting opportunity for young journalists to help solve society's problems. I think that will always be true. You know, there's the saying, if it bleeds, it leads. It means that stories of tragedy and horror and crime will always be considered newsworthy. And that's something that says something about us as human beings, I think. But media does a good job, a pretty good job, I think, of pointing out society's problems. What I think is the opportunity and the exciting opportunity for young journalists would be to find the responsibility and embrace the responsibility of also pointing out the solutions to those problems. Don't tell me that 17 high school students were mass murdered in Florida by a deranged gunman, a mentally ill person. Tell me what society is doing and what the solutions to mass murderers would be. And I think that's the responsibility that journalists have. Otherwise, we're all going to be feeling like we're all going to be really depressed, right? That can be how democracies die as well, I guess. So
people do turn in to watch tragedies, and I can't count the number of times I have watched Jim Cantore from the Weather Channel tell me about a hurricane or a tornado. And I got a whole new different perspective during Hurricane Matthew when he was in my neighborhood, and I decided it wasn't quite so cool to have Jim Cantore, you know, 15 yards from me. Justin, tell me why a young, excited journalist should be excited to go through J school or jump into a radio TV broadcasting career.
Well, from a very practical standpoint, the technology has really opened, you know, so many doors in terms of what journalists can do in an autonomous way. Right? There's no longer the big crew, especially at the local level. It's you. You are a one-man band, a one-person band, right? You're it. You're the videographer, you're the writer, you're the editor, and there's so much agency with that. You have so much control, and it's really hard to think of another field that is rewarding in the same way. The technology that used to take an entire live truck to go live from a location. Now that can all be in a book bag or even on your cell phone for that matter. And so, you know, I was able to report from the Capitol in Washington, just threw the backpack in the back of the station van, drove up there, did it myself. Mm-hmm. And previously you'd have to book satellite time and, you know, work with the network to get a photographer and all of that. And so there's just so much that you can do these days.
What a time to be alive. Thank you all for a really fun and fast-moving discussion on something we effortlessly look at every day but maybe don't always pause to think about. Thank you all for listening to 30 Brave Minutes. Tune in next time for another interesting discussion.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves.
Good job, everybody.